listening to the Tennis.com podcast. And here's your host, Ed McGrogan.
This is the Tennis.com podcast, everyone. Welcome back. This is Ed McGrogan talking with Steve Tigner. Monday, we wanted to start the week off with our weekend review. Quite a bit in the waning, really the last day of February, where all the as we make our way into March into the bigger events. But as you have written, Steve, you know, February sort of came in on a lull and really, you know, went out with a lot more than we may have expected.
Yeah, you know, this month isn't the biggest month. It's probably the least important. There's no Grand Slam, no Masters this year, no Davis Cup. You know, especially on the men's side, it's a lot of smaller tournaments. But by the end, you know, you could really see the season sort of starting, the post-Australian Open season starting with Federer beating Djokovic in Dubai, and on the same day, Nadal winning his first tournament since last year, and really starting to, you know, both of them looking good. Those were two guys that in Australia, they went out, Federer very early, Rafa pretty early. You sort of started to wonder about them, Federer getting older, Rafa always seeming to be injured. But, you know, here they were really playing the way you remembered them playing, Federer coming up with a big win over the number one player, and Rafa really finally looking like, you know, the player we remember. And judging by how he did a couple years ago on clay and what he did after that, you know, that's a positive sign. And you suddenly feel like there's a lot happening in the ATP side.
Yeah, yeah, and we'll get to all that for sure, because you know, beyond Roger and Rafa, there was even another winner that we'll get to as well that I think is worth our time talking about. But I wanted to start off with the WTA actually. Your piece on the site today is very centered on the men. We wanted to lead with the women here. You know, in reality, about one significant tournament last week that was in Doha. There was also a tournament in Monterey, but Doha was really where the major players were centered. Despite a few pullouts beforehand, you had a good field. You had a final of Victoria Azarenka, Lucy Safarova. Safarova taking that match over Azarenka 6-4, 6-3, actually went through this draw very smoothly for her. There's, you know, from the quarterfinals and beyond, she won her matches all in straights, all pretty convincingly. And, you know, Safarova is a player that I think we always, you know, we've seen her in Fed Cup for sure at the end of the years, but we've seen her really make some sort of sporadic appearances in the slams as a very tough unseeded player, and, you know, as a tough lower seed too. And yeah, I just kind of wonder, you know, we really haven't talked about her much in detail. You know, what about her game has made her, you know, makes her, you know, such a strong player at times?
Yeah, she's sort of has been an upset artist to a degree, but somehow has never been in the top 10. She's up to number 11. Now, she's 28, has always sort of been, you know, she's been the second player from the Czech Republic after Kvitova. She, she has a good game, but not, you know, she doesn't have the huge power or speed to hang with the very top players. But you always feel like she hasn't done as much as she should have. And this tournament, as you said, was a big event for her. She beat Stosur, Makarova, Petkovic, Suarez, Navarro, and Azarenka. Most of those matches in straight sets. She, from what I can see in her last two matches, she really played, you know, she really played points better in this tournament than I think I'd seen her, that I remembered seeing, constructing points. She, you know, not just going for one winner, but building a point and coming in off a good forehand and finishing at the net. You know, a little more constructed tennis than what we'd seen. And against Azarenka especially, she really used her serve well, which is, you know, a shot she can use, that lefty serve, but this time she really used it as a way to get out of trouble, which I hadn't seen as much from her in the past either. She'd never beat Azarenka. She's 0 and 0-6 before this. So, you know, to beat her in straight sets, even though Vika is just coming back, you know, that's a big win. And Safarova has gone pretty far at the slam, so she's not somebody you would think is a flash in the pan.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure it was Wimbledon that she has gone to the
she was in the semis.
To the semis. I think this was within the past 2 to 3 years. But yeah, you do have the lefty game, which is always, you know, a built-in advantage over the most part. And as you say, the forehand for her is the shot that comes to mind when I think of, you know, really the quintessential Safarova points. And, you know, as you say, these were very convincing wins. And I think, and I do agree with you, the win over Azarenka shouldn't be understated, you know, primarily because I think coming away from the first 2 months of 2015, if you want to discuss really the women's players that I think have made the most impression, Azarenka has to be mentioned in there. You know, coming into the Australian Open, getting, you know, as probably as tough a draw as you want to ask for, and going through that, you know, into the second week, and, you know, really her story has been told, you know, quite a bit now, but, you know, she's really moved past that story and really has seemed to kind of embrace her new situation here with Coach Sam Sumik it just seems like a new revitalized Azarenka, but not just in saying that, but in the results we're seeing as well.
Yeah, I think you could really. It's a good question as to which is the more impressive or more significant result: Safarova winning or Azarenka reaching the final, and the way she reached the final. That, you know, as far as what's going to happen in the future, that may be the bigger deal. She beat Kerber, Svitolina, Wozniacki, and Venus. And then she did look, you know, she had a little trouble with her ankle in the final. She just missed a couple shots at the end of the first set that I would say that she normally would make. Just a couple misfires that may have, you know, sort of turned the tables in this match. And I think she, you know, she would normally expect to make, and she expected to win. So, yes, you know, she has a new coach, Wim Fizet. And like you said, her reaching this final, you know, I feel like that in a way is maybe even the more important result from this weekend, even than Safarova's win.
Yeah, it's a good takeaway from this, and I think, you know, we'll see a lot of that bear out this month. I think maybe one thing about February is that we kind of size up the players that we really want to pay attention to in March, and that usually isn't necessarily the top players. You know, Serena, of course, is a case that we really want to see in Indian Wells, but I think that this month has given us quite a few names that we want to see if they can persist in really the next tier of tournaments just below the slams. I think Safarova and Vika are two really strong examples of that on the women's side. I think for the men's side, now I've become somehow, really, it kind of defies all logic. I'm curious to see more David Ferrer, which is not a sentence you often hear on this podcast or anywhere else, but he has got an 18-1 record now in 2015. He's got three titles, you know, before 2 months of play has even elapsed. And, you know, the David Ferrer obituary, you know, had to be taken out of publish before before this date, because it's really actually turned into probably, I'm sure, the best start of his career to this point. And you know, he was, you know, really one of, even with Federer beating Djokovic and Rafa winning, you know, his first title in some time, you know, Ferrer's win was pretty noteworthy in its own right.
Yeah, you could, you know, Ferrer, three tournament wins already, 18-1. Wins two straight weeks, one on clay and one on hard courts. He just turned 32, so all, you know, I don't know whether that means he gets back in the top five or gets back to a Grand Slam semi. I don't know if that necessarily means that, but he's another guy who's sort of in the way of any younger players coming up, as he showed in the final of this tournament in Acapulco. He beat Nishikori. You know, Nishikori was a guy who was also looking like, you know, also had a strong start to the year, also won a tournament, had beaten Ferrer four straight times, and this time Ferrer got him. So in a way, it's just another obstacle of, you know, this older generation throws up. So we'll see what Ferrer does. He's never, you know, I don't think he's ever done that much at Indian Wells, but you know, he's definitely solid for another year.
Yeah, and you know, one thing I'm thinking about with Ferrer is, you know, the comparison is not there in many ways with Rafa, but what I got thinking about is seeing Ferrer, you know, at age 32, really sort of pushing the talk of waning play and just continuing to be at the top tier. You know, he has continued to really defy that, and I wonder if perhaps for so many years we've thought of Nadal as, you know, with such a physically demanding game, as a player that would break down earlier than most other pros do, just because of his style. And Ferrer, to me, you know, plays, you know, just as demanding a style in many ways. And Ferrer, for his part, has been doing just fine going into his early 30s here. And I just, you know, wonder if maybe we are selling Rafa, you know, quite a bit short in that department as well. You know, he has, of course, injuries that Ferrer hasn't dealt with, but, you know, really every time that Rafa, you know, has made his inroads back, you know, it's been a success. And I just kind of thought about that comparison, looking at, you know, how Rafa did this week, and then again, you know, how Ferrer did this week as well.
Yeah, I think Ferrer shows that, you know, it's still mind over matter. It's, if you don't get burned out mentally, if you're a guy like Ferrer who just needs to make his money winning week by week, he's never going to win the giant paycheck at a Grand Slam or at the Masters Cup World Tour Final. You know, he's a guy who's got to play all the time. He's made a lot of money doing that, and he's still, you know, he's still hungry and has never seemed to be mentally to flag at all. That to me shows that Rafa, you know, maybe, you know, he can go that long as well. Because he doesn't seem to have he seems as, you know, as much desire to win as he did when he was 18. You know, even after, I think some of the ups and downs may help him last a little longer in a way, and that he hasn't played week in and week out as much as some other players, sort of the way Andre Agassi lasted longer than Pete Sampras. He had his ups and downs, and Pete sort of played all the way through and retired earlier than Andre. That it could be a situation where the sort of ups and downs of Rafa's career keep him going a little longer than maybe he would have otherwise.
Yeah, and you know, for this week for Rafa, he, speaking of his title win, it was, you know, as he has often done, he, you know, whether it's a small event, whether it's a major event, Rafa seems to treat titles equally, and he just, perhaps as he treats his opponents equally, he goes out of his way to say, you know, whether you believe it or not, is that, you know, he, you know, any challenge that is put in front of him just seems to be, you know, sort of a test that he measures himself against, and you know, I think that's, you know, you could say that for his whole career as to how he has treated the sport. But I think, you know, that's one thing that I noticed too about Rafa is like you say, is that desire is not gone. In some ways, it may be almost even more intense. Like he knows he has to continually prove himself against this, you know, the advancing of age and the, you know, the competition that I would say is, you know, relentless over time. And, you know, this week he gets it done. And as you say, really looking at times like the Rafa we know on clay.
Yeah, it wasn't the biggest tournament. It was a 250, and he beat his friend Juan Monaco in the final. But I felt like this is the first time I'd seen Rafa look like himself on clay in quite a while, or look like himself, you know, bring something like his best game in a long time. It really happened in the quarters against Delbonis. Obviously not a top level opponent, but just the way it all moved, hit his forehand, defended, did all the little things that sort of come back later when somebody's making a comeback. They were all there for him. And you know, that's what clay does for him, and we'll see if he can use that to move into other surfaces the way he has in the past.
So let's end with Roger Federer being Novak Djokovic. Another sentence we don't always say on this podcast. We're gonna leave this one till the end here, and maybe that kept you listening around for these past 15 minutes. But for these two, going into this week, I think you viewed this as a pretty significant, a pretty important one for Roger. I mean, Novak really has little to lose or little to gain, I think, in an event like this. Roger, coming off a title in Brisbane, disappointing exit at the Australian Open, and gets as big of a test as you can ask for at an event that he's had great success in. But he's playing clearly the number one player in the world there. How do you kind of really put this as a takeaway on from Federer? Seeing really the continued sustenance of his great play as he's really approaching midway through his 33rd year.
Yeah, he was good throughout this tournament. The fast courts helped him. The course that he likes this place, obviously, seven titles there. He looked really sharp and not a lot of the sort of rustiness you might expect or anything early on, the way he showed at the Australian Open. And against Djokovic, he outplayed him in the first set, and then he really outserved him in the second set. That's kind of the Federer MO against top players. Even when he struggles a little, he can hang in with his serve. And I think he wasn't great at the net, but just the overall aggressiveness, he really, Djokovic was always reacting to Federer, and Djokovic said afterwards there really wasn't that much he could have done. Djokovic had seven break points, and on most of them, Federer wiped it away with a serve. Federer looked like, he looked like from the baseline and being on top of his game as good as he has it. I'd wondered about what an early loss at the Australian would do for him, have to build back his momentum, but it's obviously there. He seems solid for the long haul, and really fin. Normally a match with Novak, you would expect him to win the first set, lose the second set, and we'll see what happens in the third. But this time, he seemed like he was really the better player throughout. Djokovic has, like you said, has nothing really to lose. He has the Australian Open, and Federer doesn't. But this makes that rivalry interesting again. It puts Federer back in with Rafa, back in in the mix at the top. And after the Australian, I think some people thought, well, maybe this is Novak's year to really distance himself from those guys. But I don't think that's going to happen.
Yeah, I don't think we should discount the best 2 out of 3 set format also. I don't want to take anything away from Roger, but it's always important, I think, to remember that part about these events is that, especially when it comes to Novak, who has demonstrated so well in best of 5 play, but overall, it has been a year thus far of a pretty good crop of top tier depth, again assuming itself atop the ATP leaderboard. We've really had highlights, I think, from almost all the big four at this point, and really some disappointments from players. Grigor Dimitrov definitely comes to mind, but if I want to make a specific case, but you do, we have seen some strong play from others as well. Nishikori, we've mentioned, Ferrer gets one on him this week, but this has been already, I think we see where Nishikori is going. That trend seems to be a true estimation of where we think about him, and Thomas Berdych as well, doing, I think, well over these 2 months. I don't think we want to forget that. It's been a very nice 2 months for the ATP, and I think it makes Indian Wells in Miami, I think, particularly interesting because, we'll see where they go. But I think either way, we're going to get some very strong tennis.
Yeah, it's true. Right, Federer hasn't won a Grand Slam in almost 3 years. Rafa just won one last year. So the 3 out of 5 does make a difference with these guys. But then again, all the Masters are 2 out of 3. Every tournament other than the Grand Slams is 2 out of 3. So I feel like this does these wins and Federer's win over Djokovic does have significance for the rest of the season.
Yeah, we will. We'll see where that picks up. You know, they're going to be 1-2. They're going to be on opposite sides of the draws for for both of these two upcoming Masters events. So we'll see, you know, if both of them can survive till the end. But there's much in the way, as you know, as we've discussed here. So we'll pick things up next week after a round of a significant round of Davis Cup. There'll be, you know, all 16 teams in action, of course, and much discuss as we lead our way into Indian Wells. So for Steve Tigner, this is Ed McGrogan. Once again, thank you for tuning in to the Tennis.com podcast.
You've been enjoying the Tennis.com podcast. For all the latest news and events, head over to Tennis.com.